Well, a lot of things happened today that we've been waiting for a long time. The Cleveland Cavaliers will play the Golden State Warriors. We're going to talk about whether this is maybe the most anticipated finals ever, compare it to some of these historically. Talk a little bit about this game and this series. And then the other thing we've been eagerly awaiting for a long time is the Boston Celtics offseason has now begun, and we are going to preview that, get deep into the weeds for them. We're sponsored today by Betterment. Go to betterment.com/capspace to get up to 6 months of no fees with lower cost automated investing. The cats are fired up for this podcast. They cannot sit still. But nonetheless, we will soldier on here on the Dunktown Basketball Podcast. Let's start by just, I don't want to get into the nitty gritty of this finals matchup, Danny, but can you think of another one historically that featured this much star power, would have been this anticipated, would have just been a matchup between two better teams even?
It's fascinating because, yeah, the seven All-Stars, the history between these two teams, the fact that both teams have already won a championship, not only against the other, but on the other team's home floor. Like, there are a lot of different capabilities, and this is not a situation like, and I'm not comparing these two, Miami and OKC, where OKC you go, wow, look at all the star power they're going to have. This is in their prime, or awfully close to in their prime, legitimate star power. I mean, to me, you're going back to some of the best Lakers-Celtics ones, or if we dig into when the league had a lot fewer teams, then maybe you could get into some of the star power stuff then too.
Yeah, I mean, since the merger, 1983 would be the third time in 4 years that the Lakers and Sixers actually matched up. The Lakers having won the previous two, but that Lakers team, James Worthy was injured. He was only a rookie at that point. And the Sixers, in the midst of the or one of those 4-1 team, which was obviously a great team, they ended up sweeping the Lakers. But certainly you could imagine there would be quite a bit of anticipation for that one. The first Bird Magic matchup in the finals, and then maybe the repeat of that in 85 and then 87. I mean, those would have to probably be up there. Jazz Bulls in 98, just because the Jazz had home court advantage and actually had the same number of regular season wins as the Bulls that year. But both those teams were a little bit older on the downside. That wasn't the best Bulls team. Certainly no finals featured this amount of star power over the next 10 years after that. Maybe 2008, which ended up being a Celtics blowout, but the Lakers were actually favored coming into that.
Well, something else to put into this whole thing is you and I did a podcast of who we thought were the 10 best players in the NBA, not our MVP discussion, which that our discussion on the 10 best players in the NBA. This series has three of the top four on both of our lists.
Yeah, that's good. And then obviously you've got four other All-Stars aside from those three players, and then some great role players as well. Second best player of all time, two other top 22 players. KD was 22. And Steph was 20 when NBA all-time rank by ESPN came out last year. So, but the fact that this is now the third time that they played, the fact that this Warriors team has been the best team ever over a three-year period in terms of regular season wins, but that Cleveland still beat them, and now there's the revenge factor there that we've added Kevin Durant. Although I would be more excited for the series if Kevin Durant weren't playing in it, because I think it would be a pretty even matchup in that case, and it would be that same Warriors team trying to get revenge.
We haven't mentioned the other important part of this is that, knock on wood, as of now, these teams are both healthier than they've been for either of the previous two finals.
Yes, that's a great point. And hopefully we'll see just really, really high-level basketball. And then you also look at the fact how much these teams dominated, although both of them had relatively easy paths. But, another one you could look at maybe would be 2014, the rematch of Spurs-Heat. But I think everyone knew at that point that that Heat team was kind of nearing the end. They just didn't have the role players. Wade was hobbled. It was basically just LeBron and Bosh and nobody else, really. And, it made plenty of sense that the Heat got worked in that series. So yeah, I mean, I can't, certainly since 1987, I don't think there is one that was as good of a matchup coming in. And we already talked about how we thought that game seven going into it was probably, last year was probably the most hyped game in NBA history as well at that point, and lived up to it, frankly. So I'm extremely fired up. Just a few notes on this game and this series. LeBron James just again was off the charts in this one. I mean, other than that game three when it appeared actually that he may have been sick. That's what Richard Jefferson said later on. This is one of the all-time greatest series that anyone has ever had. I mean, tonight, 35 points, 13 of 18 from the field, 8 assists, 8 rebounds, 3 steals, a block, only 2 turnovers, plus 36 in 35 minutes. Just an absolute tour de force. Kyrie Irving continued his dominating play with 24 points on only 15 shots, only got to the foul line twice. It was just absolute complete domination, especially once we got into the third quarter. And the Celtics just couldn't hang. I mean, it's really odd that they played better in Cleveland than they did at home, but maybe that's just Cleveland playing better on the road.
Scott Van Pelt said on SportsCenter that Boston never led for a second in the Garden during this series, which is insane.
Yeah, I mean, Cleveland just jumped on them early every single game. It was pretty remarkable. And what was the latest we watched any Twitter NBA show? Like middle of the third quarter in those Boston games? Like, it was just, at least we made it through the first half this time.
Yeah, we did. And something else I want to mention, because we've talked about this before, but I just find it so interesting. Early on, it was the Kevin Love show offensively. He was shooting, I think he had 10 points in like the first 3-4 minutes of this game. He ended the game with 15 points, but was plus 43 in 27 minutes.
Yeah, and it was clear in this series that he had no problems at all guarding Boston, other than maybe just, and I don't even think he was really the problem during like that game and a half where they didn't guard the Celtics that well. Really, it was probably only a full game, the second half of game three and the first half of game four. The versatility of his jump shot is really just ridiculous. Like, he ran a 4-5 pick and roll and pulled up off the dribble going to his left. He caught the ball, replaced to his right, takes a dribble to his right and hits that jumper like for a three going to your right as your power forward off the dribble. Like, that is not something that guys his size can do. He dominates on the defensive glass. He was excellent on the offensive glass at times in the series when he was asked to do that. He basically killed their switches so badly that they then had to go to conventional pick and roll coverage on his pick and pops, and they couldn't guard that either. They just, every time he was getting wide open, finally they found a little bit of a solution, it seemed like, where they just had the next pass over guy come over and just grab Love on that play, and then have the guy guarding, who was initially guarding Love, try to slide over to LeBron James, but they still gave up like a couple of quick buckets off of that coverage too, you know, when they just reversed the ball and got an open shot. This team is just absolutely impossible to guard. Like, Boston tried everything. They managed maybe 3 decent quarters of defense in the whole series.
And that ties
in with
this
was a great defensive team once Thomas went out too.
Yeah, because they lost their weakest point and replaced him with not only a guy who could defend, but a guy who was fairly switchable in Marcus Smart, you know, who can handle a lot of different assignments. And Cleveland comes into the NBA Finals with the highest offensive rating ever for a playoffs. And some of that is, you know, that you're usually facing harder teams as you go on. But when you have a 120 offensive rating through 13 games, it's absolutely incredible.
Yeah, and frankly, the one game they lost was just such an aberration as well. I will say this, though, LeBron, this is now his 7th straight finals, and that deserves a ton of credit, especially just to simply not get injured 7 years in a row in the playoffs. You know, I mean, just that level, and to maintain this level of production now, basically, as with a couple of years where it might have been questionable, but he's maintained his position as the best player in the NBA basically since 2009, almost uninterrupted. Absolutely remarkable. And to still be doing this at age 32, where frankly he looks better than he did the last two playoffs at 30 and 31. But the historical record should note that they have never had to play anybody. I think in a good way to look at it is, I think they have played one other team, and this is LeBron's teams, in the East Finals or at any point in the East playoffs that would have been a legitimate championship contender in that year, and that was the 2011 Bulls. Every other team that they've played would have just clearly gotten waxed by whoever it was in the West, even if they had managed to get by LeBron's team.
I have no opposition to that statement whatsoever. None. I mean, and it, a lot of it also, you know, there were some other teams that got derailed by injuries. But even then, I mean, that Hawks team that won 60, they weren't, I didn't think of them as a spectacular playoff team.
They had a really bad point differential that
year.
Their point differential was like, you know, 5.5 or something. And they played some dominating ball early in that season when they won like 17 straight. But by the time the playoffs rolled around, they, and I mean, you just saw they struggled for 6 games with Brooklyn and Washington. Washington, which were not great teams at all that year. So they were, and that Cavaliers team really was probably the worst entrant that James has had in the finals. When you consider that Love was out and Irving was kind of hobbled. And they still made quick work of the Hawks even before the Hawks started getting injured in that series.
Anything else you feel like we need to discuss from Game 5?
I think just Olynyk clearly can't play against Cleveland. And that's something that he had a good Game 3, I realize that. But a lot of that was just because LeBron was so just slow in that game and didn't have his wind or wasn't attacking or whatever it was. Other than that, defensively, he was just totally inadequate to deal with the shooting. I mean, even Al Horford, who, if you wanted to just pick any NBA big man outside of Draymond Green who would have to guard this Cleveland team, he'd probably be in, you know, your top two or three. Even he just, you know, really struggled in this series. I mean, it's also incredible that whenever they had Jaylen Brown on the floor, whenever it was, or even like Marcus Smart, you know, on switches, like this Cleveland team just picks at any mismatch so well. And they've started running some more intricate sets than they did, you know, back in 2015 when it was just like throw it to LeBron and let him work when they didn't have anyone else on the team. But overall, they just put their players in great position. They have great shooting around them and you just can't stop these guys. And it's pretty, they're not doing anything that's so incredible from an offense standpoint. It's just, all right, you can't stop Kevin Love in the post, you can't stop Kevin Love pick and pop, you can't stop Kyrie Irving getting to the rim, you can't stop him making ridiculous step backs, and you sure as hell can't stop LeBron James either. It's really been incredible. And so we'll get into Boston in a second here, but first I want to give you a message from our friends at Betterment. I think a lot of our listeners, based on the demographics that you guys were kind enough to fill out in that survey that you did, are, you know, kind of starting off first job, second job, you know, maybe around the time where you might be getting married, starting to think about saving for retirement, getting to the point where you're stable in your job and your life, and you want to really start building something financially. And Betterment is a great way to get started with that. It's lower cost automated investing. There are no fees for individual transactions. Instead, the way their pricing works is for their automated services, it is only a 0.25% annual fee. Or you could go with their premium package, so that requires a $100,000 minimum balance, but you can get a 0.5% annual fee there. You get all the benefits of the digital plan, and you can get an unlimited number of calls with their team of CFP professionals and licensed financial experts, and get additional account monitoring by their team of licensed experts. And also, you can get even a further discount on that because you can get up to 6 months of no fees on the digital plan, which doesn't have any minimum balance at all. So you can just get started with a very small amount. I mean, that's how you get started saving, is you use what you can, and you think that it doesn't seem like that much, but if you get into the habit of saving and you continue to do it and you invest, it adds up to something by the time you're ready to retire or ready to make a big purchase. You can get up to 6 months of no fees at that betterment.com/capspace URL. Another thing they help with for saving an investment is a product called Smart Deposit, where you can set a preset amount in your checking account that if you exceed that, you say, all right, I need $5,000 to live on. Anything above $5,000 in your checking account, Betterment will take it out and invest it for you with Smart Deposit on a weekly basis. So once again, the way to get started with Betterment, betterment.com/capspace. Capspace, easy to remember because we're about to talk about it for like hours with this Boston preview. Betterment.com/capspace is that URL. All right, buckle your seatbelts here. The Boston Celtics. This is the summer. It's finally going to come to fruition, I think, this summer, where they've gotten the number one pick. They still have this 2018 Brooklyn pick. They have all these guys on great contracts. They can still create space for a max contract. It's going to be awesome. And I'm very excited to see what they can come up with. Why don't we just start here with what some of the likely cap scenarios are for them?
So one of the basic questions with them is, can they get to max space? And the answer is yes, they can. But especially if it's getting to the, like the vet, we'll call it the Blake Griffin max, it's going to take a little bit of work that might cause some pain to them.
Yeah. The issue basically is, let's say they dump everyone that's essentially not tied down. So Amir Johnson, no cap hold. Tyler Zeller, $8 million non-guaranteed. You're cut or traded away for nothing. Jonas Jerebko not coming back. Kelly Olynyk, restricted free agent, $7.7 million cap hold. We're going to renounce your rights. James Young, adios. Demetrius Jackson, Jordan Mickey. Jackson is guaranteed $650,000, but you can probably just trade that away for nothing. Those guys are gone. Gerald Green, not coming back. All right, that's not too painful, right? But you now only still have $27.1 million in space at that point. So that's when it gets more difficult. And the reason you only have $27.1 million is you got $7 million on the books for the number one overall pick. And then you've also got Gershon Yabusele, number 16 in 2016. It looks like the plan is for him to be on the team this year. And he's already played some for the Maine Red Claws after his season in China was over. And I don't know that they need Yabusele or he's ready to contribute yet. But and if they were able to move on from him or for just another year, have him hold off. Or if they just wanted to relinquish his rights even, which you wouldn't think, they'd probably trade him or something instead. But and maybe that's what they could do is just trade him for a future second round or something. I have no idea what his worth is at this point. But then the other guy that they really are going to need for next year as cheap labor is their number 23 pick in 2016, Ante Zizic. It's already been reported he'll be coming over. He's going to be making $1.6 million under the rookie scale. And this what's made their life a little more difficult is it used to be cap holds for rookies under the old CBA were 100% of the rookie scale. Now they're 120%. That's to prevent teams from kind of gaming the system because everyone signs for 120% of the rookie scale anyway, and also just to get these guys under contract early so they can go and play in summer league and there's no issues where they're kind of have to wait to do all of their summer transactions and then sign their rookies last, like that you don't have to do that anymore. So I agree with that rule, but it does hurt the Celtics. And another thing that hurts the Celtics is that they have upped the minimum salary and thus the empty roster charge is now $800,000. So even if you're gonna knock off someone like Demetrius Jackson, who's due to make $1.4 million, you only get $600,000 in savings from doing that. Mickey, due to make $1.3 million, same thing. So actually, I think that I probably should update that because he's a little bit below the minimum. I forgot to update him. Anyway, so you only got $27 million. Even then, if you move on from Terry Rozier and Yabusele, trade those guys away, you're still not there. You're still only at 27.9, and the max for Hayward or for Blake Griffin is 30.3. So you're still not there, and you don't have any other little salaries after that. Your next smallest salary is Marcus Smart at 4.5. And then you got Jay Crowder, 6.8, Thomas, 6.2, Avery Bradley, 8.8, and then Horford making 27. Amazing that they'll have this roster with nobody making in double digits. That's how they have this space. Just incredible contracts that they've got these guys with.
And there's, I don't know if it's not irony, but it's whatever is kind of similar to that. That the Warriors were probably the team that the CBA was designed to curtail, but they're not going to be affected by these rules nearly as much as the Celtics are. And the Celtics, you could say, they're building the team to rival the Warriors, and they're actually going to be limited by this more as they move forward. And yeah, it's entirely possible that you could see Gordon Hayward or Blake Griffin take a small cut. We've seen that happen before. But it gets into this idea where the Celtics can clear the space. It's going to be challenging. And then the other thing you have to remember is that one of the ways that the Celtics could really go after this and get really special is that they could sign that player and then trade for somebody else who's really good. And you just have to also think about, well, what's left if they're going to do that? Because by the chronology and by the trade rules, you would want to make the trade, even if you agreed to it first, you'd want to make the trade second, and some of the guys that you'd want in that trade are the guys that you just cut to clear the space.
So if they're going to get to max space, now they could get bailed out. The cap is currently projected at $101 million. If that goes up, 30% of any cap increase is taken up by an increase in the max salary for the guy you want to bring in. But nonetheless, you know, if it comes in at like 103 or something, that makes your life a lot easier.
Right, and that's something to watch. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
So probably what's going to have to happen is I think they got to trade Marcus Smart if they're going to get to max space. Like that's basically your he's the least valuable guy to me. His bird rights, he's going to be restricted next year, but I don't see him ever being a good enough offensive player to be a starter. And I love his defensive versatility to be sure, but I'm not sure that he like is a player that's like indispensable for you, especially if you're getting a star in free agency, and we'll talk more about that aspect as well. Or you could also try to trade Avery Bradley or Jay Crowder if you're getting a small forward. Maybe you could finally trade small for big. I'm sure there'd be plenty of people who'd be willing to do that for Crowder, or just would be willing to give up like a pretty good draft pick. So you basically would have to take on a future draft pick if you're trading away Smart, and that's an interesting thought of like what is Smart's trade value with 1 year to go before restricted free agency. Probably not going to get a first rounder unless it's maybe from a really good team, and because I don't think anyone envisions him as a future starter at the point necessarily. So, you know, you're probably getting like a second rounder back for him, maybe a good second rounder. What do you think about that?
I think that's reasonable. I haven't looked into, for this year, obviously, I know, but for future years, who has picks for various good teams? Because that's the other logical one is like, you know, if, because does Atlanta have Cleveland? No, they don't have Cleveland's pick next year. It's 2 years away. So, because yes. Otherwise it would have been the Stepien rule, named after their former owner. But those sorts of things would be the nicest ones, because then it could be a team that's in a different place, but it's a low value. I'd thrown Utah's pick into a million, Utah's owning of the Warriors pick into a million fake trades that never happened. But that's an interesting one. And also, like, I see Marcus Smart, because I define players more by who they defend. I see him as more of a wing, and they're almost definitely...
Yeah, but he can
definitely
guard point guards really well, too.
Sure,
so
But what I'm getting at is you're also functionally going to be probably replacing him with one of the two moves, because if you're gonna add somebody, maybe not the signing if that's Blake Griffin, but probably the trade if you're trying to get Paul George or Jimmy Butler, you're probably getting a guy who's going to squeeze him out of the rotation.
Yeah, Utah actually, for the number 30 pick, might not be completely insane if Utah loses, like, George Hill, and... I mean, that would be hilarious, though, because it would be completely insane, because that would be allowing Boston to open up the space to potentially sign Gordon Hayward from Utah. But maybe there could be a transaction made there once, if it becomes clear that Hayward says he's going to leave and Boston has to open up the space. Like, that's probably what's going to happen. They probably won't trade Smart until they have a commitment and they know that Smart is a value contract. Like, you can easily get off of that money if you want to. So... let's say that they're able to bring in Gordon Hayward. That's going to be their number one target. I think we both agree that he is really the only player on the market who's likely to change teams, that, you know, would really has a decent chance of being a good contract if he signs for the max. And for the record, that would be a 4-year $130.3 million contract. He probably would want to get a 3+1, and then he could get back on the market when he has 10 years of experience, and hopefully would still be good enough to get, if not the 35% max, he could get either a 4 or 5 year deal at close to that. He would still only be 30 at that point. He's 27 right now, right in his prime. So, and that's got to be terrifying for Utah, because Utah can't really, if that's what he wants to do, Utah can't really offer him that much money. It's only like a difference of, like, you know, $1 million or $2 million over the course of that first 3 years of the contract.
That's actually a piece I'm working on for the Sporting News and had not told you that I was working about, is the idea of how the first couple of years of those contracts are there. And also the other reason why Gordon Hayward is so fascinating for the Celtics is that he doesn't force them to pick a timeline necessarily, because while he's very good right now, there is reason to believe that 2 years from now, if that's when, you know, the number one pick and the Nets pick maybe, and just whatever else they're going to do, those guys will
Jaylen Brown,
those guys will be coming into it. He'll still be really good. And when, instead of like maybe Blake Griffin, or if they wanted to theoretically go after Al Horford's former teammate Paul Millsap, those guys are probably going to be worse than they are now in a meaningful way, whereas Hayward will probably be similar, if not maybe even a little better.
So let's say they sign Hayward. Then, to me, the idea of trading for, not trading Markelle Fultz for it, who's the number one pick, but we assume that he's going to be the number one pick. I think that's probably going to be the case. Not trading him, but maybe just throwing most of the rest of your ammo into that trade. They have that pick from the Nets next year. They have a 2019 Memphis pick that is top 8, top 6, and then unprotected over the next 3 years, becoming unprotected in 2021. They have all their own future first rounders after this year. They swap it this year with the Nets. They've got Yabusele. They've got Jaylen Brown still. They've got a 2019 Clippers first that's lotto protected for 2 years and then becomes a second. So they've got a lot of ammo. Maybe not quite as much as the Sixers at this point, but I guess when you consider the guys on the roster, they probably do. Just a quick aside though, Danny, would you consider Jaylen Brown or that 2018 Nets pick the more valuable asset?
I haven't spent too much time with that draft class yet, but I think I'd rather have Jaylen right now, just because you don't know exactly what the Nets are going to be next year. They could spend a little bit. I mean, if they stay healthy, if they were pretty solid when they had Jeremy Lin and Brook Lopez together. So you have that. And I want to mention one other thing just because I love this. So the Memphis and Clippers picks that they have, which could start in 2019, both of those picks were acquired in trades involving Jeff Green. And they were in trades involving Jeff Green that were 18 months apart, because one was the trade where Boston actually traded Jeff Green to the Memphis Grizzlies.
Oh no, it was less than 18 months. apart. It was like a year apart.
Well, no, because what I'm getting at is because the second one was during the draft, actually. So what happened was...
Oh, okay.
Because
yeah,
this,
yeah,
because
eventually...
The
yeah. Yeah, that's right.
So yeah, so then the Clippers traded that pick to Memphis for Jeff Green in that ill-fated Lance Stephenson trade. And then they traded that pick on draft night to Boston for, I believe it was 2 seconds that they ended up using, one on Deontay Davis. And then the other one was on... Or was that the win? Was that the...
Yeah, no, it was Davis and Rade Zagorac.
Rade Zagorac,
I think, yeah. 35 pick in 2016. So yeah, they have a lot of ammo. And I think among all those things, you know, there certainly would be plenty of haggling over the price. They certainly would have enough to get Paul George, I think, and probably Jimmy Butler as well. Those, you would think that those teams would now, with the idea that, hey, you really need this guy to contend for a championship, and I don't know if you can do it with just Gordon Hayward, that they would definitely, there would be a very, very interesting negotiation. And maybe that even wouldn't happen until the trade deadline. And because they would have to waive Zeller, though, you would have to aggregate together basically for both those guys between $13 and $15 million of salary to get either of them next year. So that means you probably have to trade like Jay Crowder and Avery Bradley to make the math work. Smart's already gone in this scenario, or you'd have to throw in Jaylen Brown, who's making $5 million next year, and then two other guys. But yeah, it would probably be Crowder and Bradley, or maybe Thomas if they wanted Thomas, but you would think Crowder would be the guy that they would really want there. Who's on a longer term contract. Bradley doesn't really do a ton, but then maybe Bradley could be flipped into a third team or something like that. And then the assets that, you know, don't cost anything on the cap. That's probably what such a deal would have to look like. But let's say they're able to do a deal like that, right? Here's what your team looks like. At point guard, you got Isaiah Thomas and Markel Fultz. You're probably playing Paul George or Jimmy Butler, whichever of the two you get. At shooting guard, small forward, you've got Gordon Hayward. We've also got Jaylen Brown still. It would hurt them, though, because to have to trade away just to match the salary. I guess the other thing they could do, too, is if they waited until the trade deadline, they could throw in guys that they signed with, like, the room exception and some other minimum contracts that they signed to get above the cap. So maybe they'd be able to hold on to one of Bradley or Crowder if they could just aggregate enough kind of BS salary together, or even just do some trades to get some more salary on. So maybe they could hold on to one of Bradley or Crowder if they just threw in more in terms of draft picks. I'd probably want to hold on to Crowder just because he's under contract for longer. Bradley expires in 2018, as we know. And then you still got Al Horford. You've got Ante Zizic. You might have the guy that you signed for the room exception. Is that team, that's an absolutely loaded team, obviously. Can that team beat the Cleveland Cavaliers?
I think they can beat the Cleveland Cavaliers, but healthy versus healthy, I'm not sure they're favored to beat the Warriors.
I don't even know if they, I mean, if the Cavaliers are as good this next year as they were this year, which you would think they probably wouldn't be. James has got to start taking a step back someday. We say that every year, and it hasn't been true yet, really. But yeah, I mean, I think that would be a dogfight with the Cavs. They'd probably have home court advantage, which means absolutely nothing, apparently. but yeah, that would be, I mean, just a monster loaded team. And you know, it would be expensive, and then you'd run into having to re-sign Thomas or Bradley. You probably wouldn't end up re-signing Thomas, you would imagine. Then they'd just turn over the keys to Fultz, and then it'd be probably try to re-sign Bradley at that point. But man, what an absolute monster team that could be. And there's a lot of back-of-the-envelope calculations, like a lot of things could change there. Your mileage may vary a little bit, but I think pretty much everything we're discussing, like, is somewhat legal and, like, somewhat realistic. Let's get to the debate, though, that you and I had during the True NBA show today that I thought was really interesting. I was saying that if they don't get Gordon Hayward, that they should absolutely for sure sign Blake Griffin to a 4-year max contract. Same thing, 30% max, starting at $30.3 million, 4 years, $130 million. You were saying they should not. Why do you think they shouldn't do that?
It all ties in with what your goal is. And to me, the goal for the Boston Celtics, considering how high they are, unless ownership just wants to be competitive for a long time. And if that's the case, I'm not going to blame them. But the goal is to win championships. And we just talked about how that team with Gordon Hayward, they're going to be in a dogfight with Cleveland and with the Warriors to really compete. And that's about as close as you can get to a best case scenario in the near term. And for 99% of teams that have existed in NBA history, you take that and you run. No team in modern times has had that combination with the possibility of the other assets they have. And so to me, what you're doing by taking Blake Griffin, who is a very good player, but I think is just not at that kind of a caliber, is you're committing yourself to a time frame of probably the next 2 to 3 years where you're going to be very good. You might even pull a championship there, but I don't think you're really going to get into dynasty contention, and you're giving up the pieces that would, except for Markelle Fultz, presumably, or whoever they take number one, that will really lead you in that direction. So that team has an expiration date. And why I said the thing about Gordon Hayward that I did earlier is that I think that doesn't necessarily apply to him. I think his game's going to age better. So to me, the Celtics future is so bright that I wouldn't constrain it really at all. Like, I don't think that they need to do that. I don't think that they should do that unless they could get to something even better than we conceived of. And
wait, so are you talking about this? I mean, we're saying this is before you make another move to get Butler or George or some other trade target with those assets. So I'm just saying, you know, just you've got the cap space. All you're giving up to sign Griffin basically is you'd still have to probably move Marcus Smart. So that's, but you're saying if you're just, all you're doing is signing him, regardless of whether you're then making the move for Butler or George or not, which I think you could still do very easily.
Well, I think
you're saying
you
still wouldn't do it then. Yeah.
Correct. Because what it's doing is it's connecting you to that core. It's not just Blake Griffin. If you do that move, you're also re-signing Isaiah Thomas. In all likelihood, you're also re-signing, if you can keep Avery Bradley, probably doing it that way. And so my idea is that the team is going to get very expensive. And we argued actually on the Twitter NBA show a little bit about the idea of, oh, they probably wouldn't do that much with 2018 space. And I think that there is some merit to that. The year that I actually think is more interesting for the Celtics, if they go the route that I'm arguing for it, but that I think is probably the most prudent path, is 2019. So 2019, they'll still have Jay Crowder on a cheap contract, which is just ridiculous. Jaylen Brown he's extension eligible, but he's still on a rookie scale contract. Number one pick this year on that, whatever the Nets pick is. And by that point, they'll have incorporated or done whatever with the Memphis pick and the Clippers pick. We'll see. That year, you're looking something more like what the Spurs are going to look at next year with Kawhi. And while who knows if any of the Clippers guys end up as good as they are, you are the destination at that point. And if they can hit on even one or two of these picks, then they're in the conversation. Then when the Warriors are older, they're probably aging out. The Cavs have almost definitely aged out, and it's just basically you and whoever else gets like an MVP caliber player in the next 2 years.
Well, what are you doing in the interim between 2018 and now? Like, are you just going to not re-sign Thomas or Bradley at that point?
Bradley's an
Al Horford as a player option that year. He'll probably take that player option, I would imagine.
Sure.
Actually,
and at that point, you could keep him, you could trade him, you could stretch him, whatever. Like, that's at $30 million for 1 year is not nearly as big a deal. And Al Horford, we both feel, is going to be a productive player. So Isaiah, I do not want to give him his next contract, just at, especially not with Boston's future. I don't want to give him that next contract. So yeah, I probably would be. And then if you're thinking about it this way, then yeah, if you can get a good offer, you consider trading him as well. I don't think that's mandatory. We talked about this again on the Twitter show, that I think they're good enough that they don't, giving him away or letting him walk for nothing is not a big deal. Avery Bradley, I think there's a chance that you could get him at a reasonable number. Hopefully something where he could pass the Nene test, so he's a net asset. If not, then maybe you consider it. But they have enough that I'm okay with that. And it's crazy to say that because I love both of those guys. I mean, I don't love Isaiah as much as some people, but I still really respect. He had an absolutely unbelievable year. Avery Bradley is one of the best man-to-man defenders in the entire league, but they can be something else. And by that point, especially this is another where the rubber meets the road question, is by the time they have to really make those decisions about Bradley and about Isaiah, they'll have a much better idea of where they are with the young guys and where they are in terms of that Nets pick. And so maybe at that point they're going to go, well, crap, we're not as, that those aren't as valuable as we thought they were. Markelle Fultz isn't working out. You can make that decision later. But once you sign Blake Griffin, you cast that die. It's done.
Yeah, I really don't see the opportunity cost to signing Griffin. Like, it's 2 years from now, guys who in free agency, and free agency isn't what it used to be now at the designated veteran extension. I'm not even sure who's going to be a free agent in 2019. I guess John Wall, he's probably going to re-sign in Washington. And so the pitch is, and you're basically, what you're doing is you say, all right, 2 years from now, we'll be about where we are this year in terms of cap space, except we won't be as good because you're just going to be joining a bunch of guys on rookie contracts who are still pretty young. That's your pitch. You don't know who else is going to be out there with space at that point. Al Horford is 2 years older. This is a conference finals team right now. Like, I would be very very surprised if even 2 years from now, if they have space, that a free agent of Blake Griffin's caliber, and yes, believe me, I realize his flaws, we'll get to that, would be available, and B, would be willing to sign there. I think if Blake Griffin wants to come there, you sign him, because there isn't that much opportunity cost. They're going to be capped out in 2018. I mean, they've also, like, they've got this number one pick who's going to be making like almost $10 million a year. They've got all these other draft picks that are going to be coming in. That Brooklyn pick, even if it's projected at number five, that's another $5 million. So the most cap space that they could have next summer in 2018 is not very much. You could get to $33 million if you don't re-sign Smart, don't re-sign Bradley, don't re-sign Thomas. And $33 million is not really any more than you have this year when you consider all the draft picks that they're going to have, that they're going to be bringing into the fold as well. This is the year that they have space. And if you don't sign Griffin, then what is your alternative plan over the next 2 years? You're just going to not sign everybody exclusively on 1 or 2 year contracts between now and 2019, and you're going to let Thomas and Bradley go? Maybe. I mean, I just, there's not really any opportunity cost to me to signing Griffin, even if you say, hey, there's only a 15% chance that we get, like, even for a year or two, the Blake Griffin who's a dominant player. I still think that he really helps them. He and Al Horford would be a wonderful passing skilled front court that could switch onto just about anybody next year. I think that Griffin is actually a pretty good matchup against Cleveland, like, because the way the league has evolved, Griffin is actually a much better defensive player than back when he was expected to protect the rim more as a power forward. Now his ability to move his feet on the perimeter and be strong and switch is actually pretty valuable. And then you still, whether you make the move then afterwards for Paul George or Jimmy Butler or not, you still have used that space on something. Because, yeah, I realize that Griffin is not going to be a good contract by the end. Neither is Al Horford. You already got him. I mean, that's part of this timeline already. But then nobody else that you sign who's below Griffin in the hierarchy, those guys are going to be even worse contracts if you expect them to be good enough that they're actually going to make a difference for you over the next 2 years. So I think you got to use that space on Hayward or Griffin. And I think we've argued enough about that, but let's say neither of those guys wants to come, then what the hell is your plan? That's where, to me, it gets like really interesting. And I think it's a likelihood that neither of those guys ends up coming.
I think that then you're kind of in line. I think the difference between us is that I see the Blake Griffin idea as pretty close to what I see the idea that neither of them goes, which is basically just you get more patient with it. You try to get value contracts. I mean, there are going to be other players, but I mean, I know you like Danilo Gallinari. I do too when he's healthy, but I don't think want to give him his
defensively
next... exactly.
Yeah, no way.
Like, I don't want to give him the contract to be on this team. And there will be values this year. That's one of the big differences between this year and last year. But there aren't necessarily going to be values for guys who are going to be either starting or in the rotation for a championship aspirational team.
Yeah, I mean, and we know who you have to be a championship team: Cleveland and Golden State. If your guy cannot both shoot reasonably well and stay on the floor defensively, which means a lot of switching, means being able to cover 3-point shooters, means being able to credibly switch onto LeBron, probably, hopefully can provide some more on offense too, because they weren't good enough offensively in this series. If the guy in question can't do that, he's of no use to this Celtics team at all. You know, that's part of why I think Olynyk, you know, maybe a sign and trade for Olynyk might be in the cards. You could hopefully get something for him. But, you know, I think he's a quality player for 25 of the NBA's teams. But if you're really trying to play in this stratum, which by all accounts they are, he's not doing you any good on your roster, I don't think.
And that should also even apply to the higher end guys in your bench rotation. Like that could end up being a challenge.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so because the Celtics are going to need guys there too. They have a lot of good draft picks coming in, but you're going to need that sort of an asset. It's also part of the reason why I don't love Yabusele for the Celtics, because I don't think he has a place in those kinds of series. But he could be useful for another team.
He actually can switch a little bit better than people realize. And even Zizic, you know, might not work either. But yeah, I mean, I agree. And he's not like, you know, Mr. Intelligence defensively. But I mean, he's an asset. He's on a cheap contract. You can bring him in and see how he works out. And even if he's only, you know, plays some minutes in the regular season, like then he's useful. So, but let's see here, right? I'm going to list off all the players in free agency that I think could actually be in their rotation and help you. Paul Millsap, number one, they're not going to be able to afford him at the 30-35% max. Then you've got to move on for probably probably even more people. You probably got to move another guy as well. And Millsap, I think, would help this year, but we see now the combo of he and Horford does against Cleveland, and now those guys can be older. And that's a contract that really, you know, is going to be like, you know, Millsap is probably not even going to be a starter 3 years from now. Whereas, I mean, at least Griffin, to me, like, I understand he could get injured. That's a huge risk. But if he's not injured, I think he'll at least be a quality player who can be a starter for you over the course of that 4 year deal, which I'm not even sure anyone else could be. So like Taj Gibson, that's going to be a bad contract, you know, unless you can just get him for like a year or two, like really overpay for a year or two. But again, overpaying for a year or two, that doesn't get you anywhere, because it's not like you can use that space afterwards if you're keeping any of these guys around. And you can always just like totally rebuild like 3 years from now or 4 years from now, even, because you still have all these young guys under contract. So Taj Gibson, not really interested in giving him 3 years or 4 years. Patrick Patterson might be a guy, again, that you could overpay for. But like, if you think that Patterson is going to help you more than Griffin, or if you get two Patrick Patterson level guys, that helps you more than Griffin, you know, I just don't see that at all, right? And again, you know, this is a false choice because I don't think Griffin is coming. But all right, so Gibson, Patterson, all right, those guys can help a little bit. Dwayne Dedman might be a guy who just gives him a little more shot blocking. But again, you know, can he play big minutes against Golden State or Cleveland? I'm skeptical. And then you get to some of these wing guys too.
Yeah, the wing guys is kind of in some ways even more depressing, because some of the players who possibly could are restricted and they're not going to move. So we don't need to talk about KCP. KCP could, but he's not going to be in it. And then the other kind of starting caliber wings are terrifying for their own reasons. Iguodala is getting older. You know, dealing with knee soreness. Wade is probably going to opt in. Not really a fit for this series. Redick, same issue. So then you're talking more in the like James Johnson, PJ Tucker type realm. And those guys are specialists. Those guys are not starters probably at this level. They're more, you know, coming in when they do it. And both those guys, you know, have challenges guarding Cleveland in particular, just because the versatility and the athleticism that's there and their offensive limitations.
Yeah, you know, actually I think could be kind of useful for them would be Deion Waiters.
Yeah,
like just to give a little more shot creation.
He knows Kyrie
both Waiters
well.
And James Johnson. Yeah, I guess that's right. You know, Omri Caspi maybe, although he could be slowing down to the point where he can't even hang defensively against some of these guys. Maybe you could just go with like total defensive specialists like a Lukumba Mute or something like that. Iguodala, it would take, I mean, you would think just a massive offer to get him away from Golden State. And it'd be nice to have him, but, you know, I think he's really going to decline offensively. He's 33. You know, I mean, how many years of that contract is he going to be like, you know, a quality defensive stopper? Still, and can it be relied on to be healthy at the end of the year? We're starting to wonder about that now. You know, Tabo Sefolosha, PJ Tucker, like again, those guys, you really just, there aren't a lot of great options if they strike out on those first two superstars. Their other option, of course, would be that they then just trade for maybe not even Jimmy Butler, but maybe they would trade for like a Jimmy Butler and give up some assets there. And then they might even trade someone like Yabusele and someone else just to get another kind of starter level of player who's still under contract, you know, a Wilson Chandler type of guy, something like that. Would be someone that you could think about who could help and give them some more depth, maybe in addition to having gotten Butler or George. But you know, I think even for George, you know, that Brooklyn pick, I don't know, it's interesting. We've talked about this many times, but would you trade that Brooklyn pick for a year of Paul George?
Not unless I got some sort of indication that he would be willing to come back, and they can't give him the designated veteran thing. So that's in some ways that helps, because that makes it a more reasonable contract. After we have this discussion, I want you to indulge me for one small thing. I have a question for you.
Well, so the other thing too is, if we're thinking about just the value for guys who are in the last year of their contract, think about, for example, the Nikola Batum trade. He's a guy who's a starter, coming off a down year though in Portland. He was under contract for like $10 million. But then there was also some hope that he could re-sign in Charlotte, which I think with George, there's less hope certainly than they had for Batum re-signing. Because Batum, these mid-level guys, it almost sometimes makes more sense to trade for them, because you can overpay them and still think that you can get them if you have their bird rights, and especially if you're one of these teams that never gets free agents anyway, like Charlotte. And they eventually, of course, were able to retain Batum. We'll see how well that ends up working out. But, you know, they traded Vonleh, who was the number 8 pick the year before. If you want to just kind of calibrate some value there, that Nets pick clearly more valuable than Noah Vonleh was at that time. George, obviously, more valuable, but there's also less of a chance that he stays. If you're talking about a pure rental, now you're thinking more, you know, a draft pick that's hopefully not in the top 5. But your other problem is you can't really protect that pick, because there's nothing to replace it if it doesn't go that year. And that's too too risky for your Chicago or for your for Indiana. So maybe, you know, Butler, maybe you do trade that Nets pick, or maybe Jaylen Brown has shown enough that you could make the trade for him. I thought he was pretty good offensively in this series, looked bad defensively. So yeah, I mean, we're rambling here a little bit, but
okay, what but did I want to say? I want to ramble
your next thing.
Okay, so yeah,
that's what we're here for. It's fine.
This is a thing that I fully admit is not going to happen, but I think it's a good thought experiment. You and I have talked openly about how we don't think Isaiah's next contract is going to be a good one. So if you were given both the GM spot and immunity from criticism or job security issues, if Gordon Hayward said no, would you consider giving one of the guys in this loaded point guard class their next contract and move Isaiah basically as an asset play to say, hey, I would rather have Drew Holiday, or there are a bunch of different guys, Drew Holiday, Chris Paul, George Hill, Jeff Teague, give them their next contract instead of giving Isaiah his?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that they would make like slight contact with Chris Paul. Doubt that he would be interested, but you know, maybe Kyle Lowry, I would not be interested in him. No, I mean, I think here's the thing. None of those guys are as good as Isaiah next year. You've already got Markel Fultz waiting in the wings, hopefully ready to just take over as the starting point guard when Isaiah leaves. But for next year, I mean, they made it to the Eastern Conference Finals. I realize they had no shot whatsoever against Cleveland, but they still made it to the Eastern Conference Finals. They made a lot of money by making it that far, you know, that extra home game. You know, this is a team that's been starved for playoff success. It's a good market. They get better TV ratings. I don't know what their TV deal is, but certainly it can't hurt for the next time. If you look at, like, you know, whatever their like 5-year average is when they're negotiating their next TV deal, that's got to help. Suite renewals, season ticket renewals, all that stuff important. And especially even to just be good next year to get renewals for the year after that. You know, this is a business. And just making it to the second round or the Eastern Conference Finals, like, that's worth something. And for whatever you're going to trade Thomas for, maybe, I mean, again, if you look at Batum as a potential analog, and you're going to trade him for a pick in the last year of his contract, and then hope that that team can if they want to overpay and re-sign him, potentially, you know, like the same way that Charlotte did with Batum. You know, maybe you get a lower end lotto pick. They've got so many picks already. Does that really help you that much going into the future? I think Thomas is worth more to the Celtics than any other team because he can help them get back into that same level, even though he's probably not going to be as good next year, especially if he has to have hip surgery. But there's no other team that's going to get him, and now they're going to be in the conference finals.
Right.
So,
and that, yeah, I agree with that.
I mean, I guess like the only team I would think about seriously maybe adding him, what about the Bucks?
That'd be fun.
Like who could, I mean, they have what, 17 this year? I mean, I don't think they have the ammo to do it though. Like, who, they don't have anyone who's going to be worth it. I mean, maybe what if like they could trade like Chris Middleton for him or something? I don't know if
I don't think you'd include Thon, right?
No, I don't think I would, because again, the Bucks timeline, I mean, you get IT, and now you just get for the right to be where Boston was this year, and then you lose him, or you gotta pay him a crap load of money. And we talked the other day about their luxury tax concerns as well. If they had to pay Isaiah Thomas $25 million a year, they're in big trouble. Maybe they could, you know, get work it out where Boston would take back a little money from them or something to facilitate that. But, you know, they could. That's a team that really though could take a major step forward this year if they had Isaiah. But I don't think they have the assets to do it. I mean, maybe they could do this year's first rounder and, like, you know, their 2018 first rounder and swap right, or 2019 first rounder and swap rights in 2018, you know, maybe something like that could get it done. But that's still, you know, you only got the guy for 1 year. He's 29. He's not on the timeline with the rest of these guys. So I don't know if even a team like that really needs someone who can attack at point guard, you know, or like Chicago, they don't have the assets to do it either. Like, all their young guys are garbage, or at least have been so far in their careers.
Well, so I'll give my answer to my own hypothetical, and my answer is that it changed when they got the number one pick. If they had gotten 3 or 4, I would have considered something like that, because you don't know what you're going to have at point guard. But now they can get somebody, whoever it is, whoever they feel, the best guys in this draft, it looks so far like those guys are point guards. You already have your answer to that question, so you don't need to worry about the other one.
Anything else we can say about these guys? Their offseason that really has been coming to mind. I mean, let's do a prediction here. I mean, we predict they're going to draft Mark Markelle Fultz. I don't think they're going to trade him. What would you say their chances are, no inside info, just guessing, of getting Gordon Hayward?
40%.
Yeah, certainly making it to the conference finals, though they obviously got worked. Getting the number one pick, saying, hey, you know, you can grow with this guy as well for the rest of your career. They have Brad Stevens. That seems about right to me, especially because there's a possibility that Hayward, especially having seen how well getting a 3+1 worked out for him last time, you know, he's not going to have fear of doing that. And he also still has some scars from Utah not being a great environment, the Ty Corbin show, not getting a good offer and ending up having to get that 3+1 and restricted free agency that Utah matched. All that, certainly. So yeah, I'd say 40% is good. What about Blake Griffin?
Well, can I make one more point on Gordon Hayward? So yeah. Why I think Boston has a better chance than some people may think is that there is an argument they can make that is actually better than the Jazz, which is that if you want to be competitive, especially now they got the number one pick, if you want to be on a team that is a title contender, you have a better shot with us than you do with your current team. The money will be close. And anytime a team can make that argument, especially with a younger star, I think that you have to give them a respectable shot.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Like, they, to me, have a better chance, especially when you consider the uncertainty with George Hill as well, right? Like, what happens if George Hill leaves? Now Gordon Hayward's gonna be like, well, who the hell is our point guard? We're gonna go right back to winning 40 games again, which they wouldn't, but it might seem that way.
Well, and the uncertainty with their ownership group. Are we sure they're gonna go into tax oblivion to keep that team together?
Yeah, I mean, it really all depends. I think my understanding is on how much they make. You know, they pour the profits back in. So I think they could go it like low into the tax potentially. But they wouldn't have to do it probably next year, at least. It would be that then, you know, Favors could be a free agent, and do they believe in Dante Exum and all this? There's a lot of uncertainty with the Jazz as well, and they'd be a lot better off certainly if they had Gordon Hayward under contract for another year and it just ponied up a little bit more than they did that fateful offseason of 2014. So no, I think that's a great point. I think Boston does have a better argument there, especially if they can acquire him and then also say, hey, you know what our plan is? We're going to go out and trade for Paul George and Jimmy Butler. We got this deal set up right now. You come here, you're going to get to play with that guy too.
Yeah, I mean, they could have four All-Stars next year starting. Well, obviously starting.
So, all right, let's say Hayward doesn't come. What about Blake Griffin? What are the chances they get him?
I want to say 10%, but it's probably higher than that just because the Clippers can offer him more money in a way that could matter to Blake. I think that fifth year is different for him than it is for Gordon Hayward.
Sure.
And I think he really likes being in LA, you know, all that kind of stuff. He's had a very different experience than Gordon Hayward has. And also Boston, you know, it's different. I mean, and if Chris Paul's coming back, which we don't know, of course, for sure, but they might not be championship contender, but they'll still be a team that'll be enjoyable to be on.
Yeah. And Blake Griffin, unlike Hayward, as an 8-4 guy, Hayward only has played 7 years. Griffin as an 8-4 guy could get a no trade clause, which, I think that's something, maybe that's where the negotiations break down. I would imagine that if they offer him the absolute full boat, 4+1, full max, no trade clause, Chris Paul also going to stick around for that same contract, 5-year max, no trade clause, then yeah, Griffin probably signs that. If they don't offer him that, then maybe that's where it gets a little bit more dicey. And I don't know if they do offer him that. We'll see. All right, one more dumb thought exercise here because we're still spending more time on this. We've talked about this a little bit on the lottery. I think that Boston could still explore, should still explore the idea of trading the number one pick for Anthony Davis. I don't think New Orleans does it. They would probably have to throw in the Brooklyn pick as well to even get them to start listening. But I would at least make that call.
I absolutely would make that call. I mean, Anthony Davis, still super young. And yes, you do have the durability issues with him, which is certainly a concern. But I mean, he was an MVP, well, not like an MVP winning candidate, but he was an MVP, you know, top five candidate a couple of years ago. He's still only 24 years old. He still has plenty of team control, and they wouldn't be able to offer him a designated veteran contract, but they could still offer him more money than anyone else, and they would still be damn good.
Yeah, and I don't think that Markelle Fultz is like an absolute sure thing. Like we said it on our preview, I think he's well worthy of the number one pick. Like, the talent is clearly there, but, you know, he does have some stuff to clean up. I'm not saying he's going to be like an absolute surefire superstar. He doesn't run it into that category for me. But I think the Pelicans would ultimately say no to that, if only because, you know, they just traded for Cousins. That was like the linchpin deal for Dems. I mean, probably what you would do if you made that deal is you trade away Cousins as well and see what you can get for him, which is probably less than you sent out, I would imagine. So But maybe you could get more because you wouldn't have his agent saying, hey, you know, we're not going to re-sign anywhere, because he was trying to, the agency was trying to torpedo his value because he wanted the designated veteran. Now that that's not available anymore, maybe you could trade Cousins, but not sure exactly who wants Cousins, to be honest. We would have to think about that pretty seriously. But now we're really into the weeds. But I highly doubt Demps would do that because, you know, of his perpetual job status. And when we do New Orleans preview, which we prepared for, but we're not going to have time for today, we'll get to that next week. We can talk a little bit more about precisely what the consequences of that have been for the New Orleans franchise to have Dell Demps on thin ice basically every year since like 2011.
I feel like at some point we should try to, it doesn't have to be on the show, we should try to concoct what we think would be like a reasonable return for Anthony Davis, because it's incredible, but I actually think Boston has the assets, whether they have the stomach for it is something else.
All right, that'll do it for today. Please check out Betterment, betterment.com/capspace. Let them know that you came from us, and our Patreon subscription as well. We appreciate everyone who's subscribed to that. Be posting, of course, the salary sheets. I did some very extensive scenarios here for Boston that I'm going to post it on Patreon that were the basis for this. And the way to subscribe there, patreon.com/DuncanLaRue. And we will be doing Twitter NBA show at least for the Cleveland games in the NBA finals, possibly for more than that. That remains to be seen. But thanks so much again for all your support, and we will catch y'all next time. Till then.